Good evening. My name is Councillor Layla Smith and I'm Deputy Chair of the Board of the Geelong Regional Libraries, and very happy to welcome you here tonight on a bit of a damp, coolish night, so thanks for coming out. If I could just ask you to make sure your phones are either on silent or off, that would be great. And I'll start by acknowledging the Wadawurrung, the traditional owners of this land, and their elders past, present and emerging. We acknowledge all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples who are part of the Geelong Region's community today. We're really pleased that you've been able to join us here this evening. As existing supporters of the library, we encourage you to consider becoming a friend of the library and supporting the important work that we actually do in the literary world and in our community and for generations of our learning. Our friends of the library enjoy a range of benefits, including priority bookings for popular events such as this one. To find out more, you can check our website and pick up a brochure from a staff member following tonight's event, either downstairs or up here. So, for tonight, I'd like to, I'm very happy to introduce award-winning and best-selling guest, Lucy Treloar. Lucy is author of Salt Creek, which won the Indie Award for Best Debut, the ABIA Matt Rochelle Award, and the Dobie Award, and was shortlisted for prizes including the Miles Franklin Literary Award and the UK's Walter Scott Prize. Her short fiction and non-fiction writing are featured in many newspapers and magazines across Australia, and I'm sure you're familiar with Lucy's work. A graduate of the University of Melbourne and RMIT, Lucy works as a writer and occasional teacher and a guest lecturer in creative writing in other places. She's currently undertaking a PhD and beginning work on her third novel. She's joined in conversation tonight by John Bartlett to discuss her eagerly anticipated second book, Wolf Island, which has been described by Thomas Keneally as an important literary fable of our period of history. John is author of three novels, Towards a Distant Sea, Estuary, and Jack Ferryman, Reluctant Private Investigator, as well as All Mortal Flesh, a collection of short stories, and A Tiny and Brilliant Light, his published non-fiction. His poetry has been published in a number of Australian and international journals, and we were very pleased here at the library to be able to launch his latest collection of poetry, The Arms of Men, in June. What a fabulous and wet day that was too, John. Anyway, please join me in welcoming Lucy and John.
Thanks very much, Margot, and hello again, Lucy.
Hello, John. John interviewed me at the Melbourne Writers Festival a few years ago, and he was fantastic.
2017, I think, yes. Of course, your brilliant novel, Salt Creek, which is still one of my favourite books ever, and I guess we've all been sort of anticipating your second novel. Does that sort of a bit of a worrying thing to have people anticipating a second novel? And
yeah, it's terribly worrying. I had quite a few people contacting me while I was writing this book saying, oh, I love Salt Creek, I hope your next book's going to be just the same. And I just kept on thinking, it's really not, I'm sorry about that, but I hope you like it as well, because there are many similarities in terms of the interest in landscape, characters, rich characters, families, the abiding importance of love in our lives, I think.
Yes, it seems a different book, but you know, there are, as you say, lots of similarities. It's hard to categorise this book. That was one of my, not problems, was one of my delights, I guess. It's such a multi-layered sort of a story. Mm-hmm. And we as readers, we like to categorise writers and put them in boxes and say, it's that sort of story or it's this sort of story. And I really struggled to do that. But I'm going to have a go and say, do you mind it being called a climate change novel? Is that tying you down too much?
I don't mind it, but I do disagree with it.
What way?
I think climate change novels typically are mostly concerned with the effects of the climate on people's lives. I am mostly concerned with the people and the lives that they're living and on the general range of impacts that they might be experiencing. And in this novel, it is a world that is in a state of some flux. And that's not only related to climate, but it's related to a shifting political world, a time of great social unrest, as well as a time of changing climate. But climate change novels typically are set quite a long way into the future. But this novel is set in the United States, and I know I visited there a couple of times, not thinking that the climate would factor very much into the actual novel. But I kept on seeing things and thinking, wow, it's really here, you know, the world's changing. It's happening right here in front of us in this bit of the world.
Well, one thing it certainly isn't, it's certainly not a science fiction novel. I mean, people write about the climate, you know, and put it ahead, you know, a couple of hundred years and write a very apocalyptic sort of story. But yours is a very familiar territory. It's certainly not science fiction, is it?
No, it's not. And I have read a little bit of science fiction, but it's not for me. I know it's for a lot of people. For me, there is so much emphasis on creating a world that is the thing that I'm constantly thinking about, maintaining that feeling of the foundations of that world. I'm always more interested in the people who are living in the world, or whatever beings. I've got some dogs who feature fairly heavily in this world, in this book. Those are the things that principally interest me. What's going on in people's lives? What are the factors? Why am I writing about these people, I suppose? But the climate and the idea of writing a long way into the future creates problems, I think, because we all like to think of ourselves as kind of fairly safe, fairly secure in the worlds that we live in. And I think science fiction sometimes has an effect that is unintended of pushing strangeness away. Whereas in fact, I feel as if we're surrounded by strangeness. And because we're so used to it, we sort of hardly notice it. And if you know, an effect that often happens when you go overseas is you start noticing things that seem a little bit different from Australia, and you come back and you think, oh no, we're doing that here too. But it's seeing difference that makes you see something in your own world, I think.
Mm. There certainly is a very menacing sort of world. I mean, the seas are rising, the salt's rising in the earth, things seem to be falling apart. And there's also, which we sort of recognise because we're seeing that, you know, at the moment, so it's not really hard to imagine that. And there's also a sense of menace. I mean, there's lots of words that we sort of recognise, I suppose, runners, illegals, homeland security, all those sorts of people being put in cages and that. That's all happening too. Society does seem to be breaking down in this story. And yet, there's bits that are familiar. We can't push it away because we see it now, really, don't we?
And again, that is happening in the book, but it is happening in the world, in that world. And I spent a couple of really great months in the United States traveling around. I drove thousands of miles through this particular region that I'm writing about. And I kept on noticing things that I wasn't really expecting. There are these islands that have been breaking down for, you know, 100 years or so. They've been disappearing for a really long time. It's a very kind of changeable landscape. And I got out of the car into this extremely flat landscape, an island, a narrow strip of island. And I just stepped off the side of the road, off the tarmac, and I could feel the ground kind of quivering under my feet. Like actually almost in a jelly-ish way, and it's just this kind of web of roots of this grass that's holding together this extraordinary world. And then I could see all these dead trees around, and I thought, oh, salt's rising, and how would you grow vegetables? And I was thinking, I would have raised garden beds, that's what I'd do. And I started looking out, and like 5 minutes later I came across this house, and it had these raised garden beds all covering its front garden. And I was like my little eureka moment. I thought, I'm on it. I can kind of understand this world a little bit now. I can see what they're against. But is there normal?
Yeah.
So it seems dreadful, it's rising salt, but it's the salt that's been rising for, you know, decades for them. Their islands have been contracting for decades. So the contraction that's happening now is nothing really amazing or dreadful. Mm. It just is. It's part of life they have to deal with. And I feel like that's the way things are for us here. We've got, you know, we all accept that bushfire reports are part of our lives, but when I was a child, we didn't have daily bushfire reports in the summer, or, you know, dam levels. They're all part of our new normal, and they've just kind of crept up on us in this incremental way, and that's our normal. Mm. But it has some of the features of what you might call a dystopian world. It's strange, it's nothing good, but yeah.
So it's such a big story, it's such a big canvas. What's the trigger that sort of got you into that? What was the spark that made you start the story? Such a huge story.
Yeah, well, it wasn't big in the beginning. It was quite a little story I had in mind. I saw a photograph of a three-story clapboard house, as they call them in the States, weatherboard. And it was perched on an island about the size of a suburban block. And the house took up almost the entire island. Fairly substantial house, and by the side of the house, pulled up as if into its driveway, although it was sea all around, was a little bobcat. The house was semi-derelict, and the waves are kind of lapping up against what remains of its shores, and then there's the bobcat that you know instantly has been trying to kind of create some buffer against the waves. And it was that picture. And it's a very intense picture, this white house, the blue sea, the blue sky all around, this bright orange bobcat. It was like a kind of children's drawing in a way, and it just kind of hit me. I thought, oh, that's my next book. And then I thought, I have no idea what I'm going to do about that. And instantly, I pictured a woman standing in the upstairs window, and things started evolving really quickly, along with my great concern about how I was going to write a book about this extremely small location.
So before we get to that woman in the upstairs window, just something about the location, because I did feel a sense of, I suppose, dislocation about where this was happening. I was actually confused. I know it's in Chesapeake Bay, there's that reference, but it's not particularly American. There's no American sort of references particularly, and I thought, where is this happening? It could be anywhere, really.
Yeah.
So was that sort of deliberate, or?
That was the idea that it was, this is that world, but it is all worlds at the moment. There's a part of the book that I wanted to work on a kind of mythical level. It has a kind of fable-like feeling. So I wanted it to be something that could be approached by people from a range of cultures and countries. It was one of those, the only reference to the United States is to the Chesapeake Bay on the blurb, and that was a very late decision. Is this going to be helpful for readers or not? Is this going to help them anchor it? And I think it has been good, because I've had people get in touch and say, oh, they've looked up pictures online so they can kind of see what these incredible ruins are like. Because it's a landscape that's filled with ruined houses that are, you know, they've just been abandoned, they're derelict. They're incredibly poetic and sort of foreboding sometimes, but sometimes just kind of magically weird. So I went exploring through all these amazing houses and just try and feel that place into me. But yeah, I did want it to feel like not only that place, but it is quite a weird landscape when you're there. So it does feel like the Chesapeake.
So that sense of dislocation that I certainly felt as an author, it was also a little bit about a dislocation in time. As I started reading, it seemed like a medieval story, but then of course computers started popping up, so I thought, well, it's now. Was that deliberate too, that sort of sense of time dislocation? Was that actually?
It is quite an otherworldly place. Mm. So a lot of these decisions came out of me trying to create a sense of the strangeness of that world. And in a lot of ways, I suppose you get the same effect or similar effect from people who live in Tasmania, that they don't quite feel Australian, they identify as Tasmanian. And people who live on these islands in the Chesapeake, they say, yeah, they're islanders. That's that's their world, and they speak in a very distinct accent. It's supposed to be the closest thing to Elizabethan English that you can hear anywhere. And if you look up recordings on YouTube of them speaking, it is amazing. I just kind of sat in this island cafe listening in on conversations thinking, I have no idea what you just said, but it sounds really great. It's just very, very otherworldly, and they don't really identify with the States. Yeah, so I think that dislocation is a little bit about trying to create that feeling and a kind of and how, in a way, we all live in a timeless time, in mythical times.
Well, it's a very powerful sort of feeling, I think, that I certainly got that sort of sense. It was not a bad feeling, but it just felt like the right sort of feeling for the story, really. Yeah. And did you know that Wolf Island, I did some research on Wolf Island, because I thought, where's this Wolf Island?
Yeah.
And there's a Wolf Island in Ontario.
Yeah.
And I looked it up online, and the first news item was about houses being washed away from the sea.
It's a weird coincidence. No, I came up with Wolf Island all on my own. And then I didn't know until the edits were coming in. The editor said, oh, you know, I can't quite work out this location that you're talking about. And she picked up this Ontario Wolf Island. There's another one off Prince Edward Island too, I think. I came up with Wolf Island on my own because I was travelling around, and quite a few of those islands get named after either people or animals. And there was a Goat Island, and there was no way I was going to call that book Goat Island. There's nothing poetic about a goat. There's nothing you can do with goats as a metaphor, except of, you know, rural life or something like that. So I thought, fox, no, not hard enough, wolf. And then instantly ideas started kind of unravelling, expanding from that moment. And wolves and wildness turned into a really important kind of metaphor for various things in the book. Yeah, so, and then I found out about Ontario, and I thought, it's my name, all right.
I thought of it first.
Yeah.
We'll hope we'll get to the wolf bit, the wolf dog, because that's quite important. But we should probably talk about this woman at the window, I think, Kitty Hawk. Her mother describes, I think, as part wolf anyway. She's not really a sympathetic character. She's the main character. She tells the story. She's almost allergic to love. She's a loner. She's left her family on the mainland, and she's happy to be on this island doing what she does and keeping away from the rest of the world, the crumbling world, I suppose. Yeah. Why is she the appropriate person to tell the story?
Well, she's a sort of, first of all, I should just say she's very lovable.
Eventually.
And she does love her family, and she does a lot of good, and she's very fierce. But why did I choose her? Well, to me, she's one of those sort of in-between people. Like, we all have a kind of a facade that we present to the world, a kind of, you know, our pleasant selves. She's got worn out with presenting her pleasant self to the world, and her wild inner self is just kind of bubbling up. It's this kind of frustrated self that has been looking after everyone, thinking about other people for a really long time, and it's just, she's got to that point where her children are old enough, she thinks, not to really need a huge amount of input. And so she just sort of drifts away and moves back to the island after they've all left to fulfill her own creative impulses. And I think that she's something that a lot of women probably would identify with. I think that happens a lot with women, that they end up doing the things they should do, that they're expected to do, that they feel they must do. But there sort of comes a time where some women just say, that's enough. And Kitty Hawk is one of those people who doesn't want to be, I suppose, intensely frustrated when she gets to the end of her life. Mm-hmm. Yeah, she's just drawn a line in the sand. But this idea of semi-wildness and kind of civilization is a thread that runs through the book as well, I think.
Mm. Yeah. Well, she does get dragged back into the real world, really, without giving sort of too much away, but her granddaughter arrives on the island with a young man and a younger boy and his younger sister to come to stay with them, and she's almost unwittingly drawn back into their lives, and she becomes their defender in the end. I mean, she's incredible, and she crosses a few lines in order to defend them under this, you know, really strange sort of situation that they're living in.
Yeah.
So she does become a magnificent character, even though she's got that sort of yearning perhaps to be on her own and just to not bother about the world.
I probably wouldn't say not to bother about the world, but a kind of determination not to have the world defining her in the way that she probably felt that it was. But there is that, but she does have some feelings of regret about her actions and a desire to atone as a result of things that happened to her children. And so when these young people arrive on the shores, she is resentful at first. I think that would be true to say. But she relinquishes that reserve that she had and kind of lets herself go over to that feeling side of herself. And becomes their champion and does unexpected things, finds out unexpected things about herself, what she's prepared to do for the people that she realises that she loves. And I think it's a kind of interesting journey, this her journey back to being a really feeling person again.
And are we reading too much into the story making reference to her name, Kitty Hawk? Is that a deliberate... I think, does that mean anything?
Or well, the opening line of the book says, I think my father always said, with a name like Kitty Hawk, I'd surely fly away. And I think that's a kind of, that's a surface meaning. It's just a nice family story. It's something that she loves remembering her father saying to her. But there's a kind of thread that runs through the book with people are named after animals and animals are named after people. So she has a wolf dog called Girl, who she adores, and but her granddaughter is called Cat, she's called Kitty. And Kitty's, that's an animal that's not very, it's not dangerous, but it's potentially dangerous. A hawk is a predatory bird, that's a bird that will attack to survive. And I think the names do have those resonances for me. So that first meaning, you know, that first family story, meaning is just that kind of superficial one. But there are the deeper metaphorical resonances of names. And there's another name, Hartford Darkness.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about Heart Darkness. Now, one other reviewer has actually picked up on that too, but I did think, are you getting into Conrad here, Heart of Darkness?
Well, I'm a big fan of Conrad.
And I can see lots of connections.
When I thought of his name, I thought, oh, that's a bit Conrad-y, isn't it? Well, that kind of works, but it didn't seem quite right because he's a nice character. Hartford Darkness is Kitty Hawk's husband, and he's lovely. You will love him.
He's a hero.
He's really gorgeous. Anyway, Hartford Darkness, I kept on thinking, that's a bit of a grim name for a person who's really pretty great. But I kept on feeling this great resistance to changing it. And I have learned, I sort of sometimes feel as a writer, I haven't learned a huge amount, but I have learned to respect those moments of great resistance. And I realised at the end, after I'd finished writing, that what it really is it is his heart, the thought of his heart, that helps Kitty ford the darkness. So it's ford as a verb rather than as a kind of misspelling of.
You know? Okay. So we can cut Conrad out completely. Oh, then I started going on.
I do love Conrad.
Well, that's right, but there's questions of sort of going into the darkness of morality.
There absolutely are. And will he forgive whatever she's done? And I think that, it's the importance of love in this book and of people's ability to forgive each other. I think that's incredibly important, and that name is a reminder of that to people, I think.
There is great trauma in this story too, but I think there's one line there where I think Kitty probably says, the world is inexplicable in its miracles and horrors. And there's both sides. I mean, there's some really terrible people, vicious, cruel people. But there's this little acts of kindness sort of all along the way too. Is that a part of the story, that sort of combination of... It, to me, it sounds like the real world.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah, it is the real world, I think, isn't it? And any of us going about our days come across, you know, people who are kind of gratuitously mean and people who are friendly and helpful for no good reason. And so it was for this family when they were on their travels. They end up leaving the island. They're forced to leave the island to escape some danger. And they come across some wonderful people and some people who are cruel for no good reason, and from people who are just simply indifferent. But I didn't want to paint a kind of relentlessly bleak world, because I don't think it is. And I think that one of the things, if there is anything I wanted to say in this book, it is that people persevere, they continue to care about each other, they're adaptable, and that's what it's like for this particular family.
And when you mention the family, and the family is sort of what keeps this book together, a very much a non-nuclear family, but I was sort of thinking too about the family in Salt Creek, which is sort of very much part of that story too. It's the family in the end that sort of really holds everything together and keeps, you know, the terrible effects at bay, really, despite the tragedies. But it's a very strong sort of grouping of people. So family is sort of very much, family and kindness is very much at the heart of it.
Yeah, well, I think it is to an extent, but it is also about how families can fragment, but can create something out of those fragments. And it might be something better than the original thing. Yeah. But that people will persevere and make connections and support each other and love each other.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So very, a bit like Salt Creek in that way.
Yeah.
And the other connection with Salt Creek that I thought, I think there's a line in Salt Creek, something about things fall apart gradually. I can't remember the exact line, but I was struck with it at the time. And we see in Salt Creek there's that sort of deterioration of Indigenous culture once, you know, non-Indigenous people start settling in the area and the mouth of the Murray and Coorong and that. And there's that gradual sort of deterioration. But we're seeing a bigger deterioration. This is sort of the long-term effects of that deterioration.
I think that's exactly right. And I sort of think of these, people ask me after I wrote Salt Creek if I might think about writing a sequel, and I think I kind of did. For me, Salt Creek is about the beginning of the colonisation process. It's in one culture invading another one, destroying it. And this shows that end point of capitalism, I suppose, in a way, of a culture, a way of life falling apart. And it's just, I like focusing on that in-between moment before the chips have fallen. I like looking at the chips falling. What's going to happen in this moment when people have to leave this island that has been part of their family life for 400 years? But, you know, that's how many generations they've gone back. What are they going to do now? I love those kind of in-between moments in cultural life, and I'm really interested in looking at Australia at the moment and thinking that we're approaching one of those in-between moments, and what are we going to do? And I think that the sense of unease that a lot of us would probably feel looking at the news is to do with our awareness of that kind of changing world that we're living in.
Mm-hmm. I want to pick up on sort of some of the those sort of themes and some of the metaphors, perhaps, like the island idea and the water, and particularly the idea of sort of journey, the journey theme, you know, which is of course is a universal theme in literature, but in this particularly that idea of journey, going north. I know it's sort of pretty obvious in Margaret Atwood's The Handmaid's Tale, everybody's escaping north to Canada, and I was thinking too of Cormac McCarthy's The Road, where there's that sort of journey, escaping to somewhere perhaps better. Is that sort of a theme that you picked up on? I was also thinking of in America the slaves escaping north from the south, the Underground Railway.
It is definitely that idea, the slaves escaping north. That was definitely a conscious theme, because there was a big part of the slavery route that ran through the Chesapeake Bay, and there was this incredible moment one day when I was driving up a road up a stretch of highway called the Frederick Douglass Highway, and he was an escaped black slave, and incredibly significant and influential in the anti-slavery movement. And pulled up on the side of the road was a kind of prison truck, and every prisoner there was black, and they were having to pick up rubbish. That was just their kind of prison duty that day. They were picking up rubbish on the side of the road, and I thought, I cannot believe this world. And you know, they will have been in jail for the most minor infractions. The system there is just so appallingly unjust. I just thought, well, that's pretty dystopian, isn't that? These prisoners, black prisoners, picking up rubbish on a road, a stretch of highway named after the biggest black anti-slavery person there was. It was just irony reverberating as hard as I've ever felt it. But with the other things, the road, I don't like the road as a book. And I only read it after I'd finished writing this book. Mm-hmm. And I thought, I'm glad I didn't read it, because it just seemed to have tipped over some edge into utter implausibility. And so it didn't work for me. But I do love his other books. And the book of his that was important for me was one called The Crossing, which depicts this young man who is trying to walk a wolf back to its original place, the place it would have come from. And it's about that journey. And the way that journey unfolds, this kind of episodic nature, it's like this kind of thread of a ribbon of a plot. It's very kind of low. There's no kind of enormous dramatic moments, none of those massive peaks and troughs, but this kind of gentle ribbon was really influential for me in writing this book. Margaret Alday also, but I never got through that, The Handmaid's Tale. But the north, the journey's north. I mean, that actually happens. There are these kind of special little routes where people who are trying to escape from the southern, South America, there are these little routes into Canada. You can just walk up, it's like through the back of someone's back farm gate. It's incredibly specific. I read this article about it, and it's very well trodden, and these people just kind of, they dump their cars on one side of the border, and then they kind of open the farm gate, and there's a sign on the gate saying, please close the gate behind you for the refugees. And then they walk through the gate into Canada and freedom. That was where that came from.
Well, you mentioned that freedom is a pretty run-down city on this side of the border.
Based on Detroit.
Oh, okay.
That's what Detroit is like.
Very run-down.
Really emptied out. The population's plummeted.
But I like the way that you don't spell everything out for us, because we don't quite know where they're going. We know that they're heading to this place called Freedom, and they've got to cross the border yet, but we don't know what's on the other side of the border. And I like that sort of idea, because it doesn't tie everything down to geography again, and leaves us the room to imagine what's happening. Yeah. So I like that sort of aspect.
And to extrapolate to our own situation with our own refugee problems. And I saw someone reviewed it the other day and said, wouldn't it be great if she'd made a set in Australia and they could have been escaping to New Zealand by boat? And I thought, great idea, you write that book. This is the book I wrote. I take the point, and I wanted it to be a general point that there is a general refugee problem, and there will be for, more than a century to come. We're in for massive amounts of population movement. Mm. And this book is just about the kind of the first trickles at that, I suppose.
It's a generic transferable story, so it can be transferred anywhere, really, onto any landscape.
Yeah.
Particularly the way the world is now, because
it's kind of mythical, like in the way that a myth operates in a broad way.
I was asking you before we came on about plot, because I read something. I was quite shocked, because you were evidently talking to someone who was interviewing you about Salt Creek that said you never bother much about plot. But I do think that you do make us work quite a bit with plot, because there's one point in the story where I really had to sort of stop, and it's like there was sort of delayed storytelling. Because Louis, one of the characters, we won't say what happens, but they get to freedom and they're there, and then Kitty comes back again. And then a bit later there's this little episode, and I thought, gee, I must have missed something here.
It's an expression of her shock. She's shut down, she's not thinking about that. And so
I've never seen that done before.
I've seen it. It has been done before, but it is a I wanted a really big break. There's something very terrible that happens, and Kitty is, she's grief-stricken and I think in a state of acute shock. Mm. And so she just shuts down thinking about the terrible thing that's happened. And then she creates something and is able to start writing down what's happened. So I wanted that break to give some sense of the huge emotional break that there had been for her. In the sense of plot, I'm never fussed about having to go back and double check just to see if I've missed something important and then think, oh no, that's interesting. I do care about plot, but I just don't care about it the most. I will always care about people, the characters that I'm writing about, the landscape that forms them, that they're part of, that made them in my view, and see how they react to those circumstances. And for me, that's where plot comes out of. If you pay attention to the landscape character side of things, the plot will arrive. And it certainly happens sometimes that I'm, sitting at my desk thinking, oh, I have, what is going to happen next? And I had this terrible pause for about 2 months when I was writing this book, and I would just sit there grinding out the words. And I came to this realization one day, there's nothing for it, they have to leave the island, that's it. And as soon as I made that realization, which I just hadn't had in my original thinking, I just thought, that's it, they've just got to leave the island, and bam, like the writing took off again. So that's how plot would happen for me. I would never think about plot at the very beginning and exactly how I want things to unfold. But I do know there's some writers who form a really detailed plot and then they're kind of essentially colouring it in. I shouldn't say it like that. It seems a bit like colouring in to me. They have the plot structure and then they fill in the detail. I don't do that at all. Yeah.
You just said something before about Kitty writing things down, and she writes a lot of lists of things. Mm-hmm. I didn't quite understand why she had to write lists.
I think the lists were another one of those things that I just thought, no, that's right. And I kept on thinking, I wonder why she's writing those lists. She writes lists of kind of seemingly random things, things that she wishes she'd taken with her on the journey, things she's seen around the island, lists of dragonflies, lists of food that she wishes she had when she's on the run, all sorts of things. But I think one of the things that's doing is trying to create... they're like building blocks in a way. She's lost her whole world. Her whole world has crumbled. It's fractured terribly. And she's trying to recreate a sense of what that world was. And so she makes these lists. It's like that. It's like a kind of soothing or calming mechanism in a way that makes her feel some sense of control over the world that she has and reminds her a little bit of the world that she's lost as well. I think it's somewhere around that. And it's her observation. She's an artist. And she's a very keen observer of her environment, of the world that she's travelling through. And trying to make sense of both of those things, I think, the whole time.
Is that what she's doing too? Because as you say, she's an artist and she does what she calls the makings. Mm. So she sort of scavenges things from the beach and bits and pieces of it and puts things together from that. Is she trying to make sense of this sort of detritus that's washed up on the shore, trying to make something out of it to get some sense out of what's happening? Is that what she's doing?
I think she probably is on an unconscious level, but I think for a lot of creative people, they don't necessarily understand exactly what they're doing in the creation process. And I think if I were to look at her work, I would say she's in a crumbling world, but she's building something out of that ruination. And I think that is a pretty incredible thing that people do, that they will keep making things. They will keep existing, living, making sense of their world, even if those worlds are slightly falling apart. Mm. People always say possessions are not, they don't matter. Mm. But we all love our possessions, don't we? They do matter, in fact. And that's why people feel dreadful grief if they lose their possessions or they're stolen. They really matter. They signify a huge amount about our connections to family, to people around us. And all of those things that she picks up or that she scavenges from the houses that are broken down are a way of her creating out of destruction. And I think that is such a human impulse, the ways that we all do that.
And what we haven't really emphasised really, which is so strong, is that her connection to the natural world, you know, it's incredible. This natural world is decaying and falling apart, but it is very beautiful. It's beautifully described, and Kitty is so much in contact and connected with that world, isn't she?
Yeah, I think she feels incredibly at one with it and at peace with it as well. I think for her, the life on the mainland was a kind of state of existential turmoil, really, that it was just a constant feeling of being disconcerted by things that she had around her or being driven personally in directions that were against her nature. Yeah, but on the island she feels absolutely right with herself and right with the world, apart from her niggles about her family. Yeah.
Well, that sort of connection to the natural world is sort of leading up to what might have to be the last question. I have many, many more questions, but we are running out of time. But that connection to the natural world that comes so easily to Kitty, there's an Indian writer, Amitav Ghosh, who's written a lot on climate change and writers, and he says that the climate change crisis is really a crisis of our disconnection from the natural world. That's what's really happening. So we've lost that connection, and it's a crisis of imagination. We've actually lost that. So that what Kitty has so much so strongly is the sort of thing that we've lost. Do you think there's something in that?
I certainly do. I completely agree with that. And I think the increasing density we have in urban areas enhances that disconnect that we have with the natural world. And recovering that sense of the mystery and wonderment of the natural world, I think, is such an important thing, and probably should be, you know, just to load up school curriculum a bit more, should be something that's emphasised. I think people have lost that to a large degree. It's frightening.
Yeah, it's unfortunate, isn't it? Yeah. So just probably the last bit of that question before we have some questions from the audience is that Indian writer, he's written a lot on climate change. When writers write about issues, do you think we sort of think we can make a difference? We talked before we came on about, no, we don't want to be bashing people over the head with ideas. You know, it has the opposite effect. It turns people off. But so how do we actually have an effect, I suppose, do you think? Or is it accidental? We don't set out to sort of change the world, I think.
Yeah, I really dislike this kind of writing, so it's difficult for me. The idea of changing people's thinking is no part of my writing process. I don't approach writing thinking I must write about climate change and the parlous state that the world is in today. I would never frame a book in that way in my mind before I started writing. I will always start thinking, who's this person? What is her what is the situation that she is in? What's the world that she lives within? What could be happening? That's how I approach it. And then towards the end, I would start seeing that kind of thing coming out of it. And as soon as someone says climate change, I just think, oh, that is such a turn off. Like, if I read climate change, I'd think, please don't, you know, label the book. Not, this isn't you, but like a couple of reviewers have said, it's a climate change novel. And I think it's a modern novel. It's a modern novel set in a rural area in the United States, and things are happening in that world. And not to write about those situations would be a fantasy novel, in my view. So I've written a realist novel, drawing connections between the political world and the natural world, and hoping that people can make connections with what's happening in Australia as well. I don't know, climate change is just a tricky one, isn't it? And the idea of, there's a couple of novelists I used to love, and they just started, it's like they go into their books with a great big baseball bat over their shoulders, let me tell you. And I think it's pretty, I feel insulted sometimes. I just think, I do get climate change, thank you very much. I don't really need you to kind of hit me over the head with it. So I think it's really important to present the world as it is, not to bury our heads in the sand, but I also think it's important to depict people the way they are and not to depict that world as something that's other. It's not other, it's the world we live in, and how are we all living in that world? I think that's really interesting, and I think people are pretty incredible the way they address these issues. So for me, it's sort of a hopeful book.
Well, it's the sort of book that I think is going to connect with many people. It's a beautiful book, very very strong, but very beautiful at the same time.
Thank you.
I think we've got some questions perhaps from the audience.
Thanks, Lucy, and thanks, John. That was a great talk, and I'm really looking forward to reading the book now. I'm interested in your comment, because we have lots of authors come here and they talk about how they write, and you talked about how you write. When you read, can you tell how someone else writes? So you say that it evolves. If you were to pick up something where someone had so-called sort of filled it in, would you be able to tell that?
I know of a couple of detective fiction writers who are what I call, Elizabeth George is a great one for constructing a whole edifice and then kind of colouring it. I think it plot, some crime writers will do that sort of thing, they'll do some plotting. And you can always tell if a writer has really gone in with an idea that they are determined to discuss before the readers. And Barbara Kingsolve would be a classic of those. She was, like, her early books are incredible. They're wonderful, wonderful things. But of more recent years, she's become more of, I call her a sort of preacher, really. And some people love that. They love being told what to think, but some people don't. Yeah, but you can tell that she's gone in with an idea that she really wants to discuss. And there's a big audience, and different writers suit different people, and she's got a big audience. Yeah.
How long did it take you to write this book and compare it with the previous one?
It's a bit of a sad story. Salt Creek took 1 year, and this one took, I think, 3 years. Two and a half or 3 years, and I was in a state of quite some despair with this one for a while, just because of that dreadful phase that I mentioned earlier when I, they were stuck on the island, and I just thought, what? This isn't enough, something has to happen. I've got to get them off the island. It was quite claustrophobic, but not in a really interesting, dramatic way. And I ended up kind of carving out about 50,000 words of that phase of the novel. And as soon as they moved off the island, the writing proceeded quite quickly. But it did go much slower than Salt Creek. And part of that was that I had these two long trips to the United States, and I sort of had to process what I'd seen after I'd been there. I kept on seeing things and thinking, oh, this is really fascinating, but I couldn't quite see how it would connect to the book itself. And it was funny when I came home and started writing little scenes using that material from those journeys that I took, that I could start to see how it impacted on plot, how it would have affected characters, seeing the things that I'd seen. And so a lot of the imagery from the journey section of the book, which is the middle section of the book, is built on my impressions of that world when I was travelling around it myself. And so that bit, that was probably the best writing phase for me. It was the bit where I felt the best connection with the material. It was also the bit that took quite a bit of processing to get right just to know how to frame that material for the text.
More questions? There's one here.
I finished Wolf Creek Saturday. Wolf Island Saturday.
Oh, did you? Well done.
I just adored it. It was fantastic. But what I wondered is, what's your background as far as science and nature and everything goes? Because it comes out really strongly in the book to me.
Great. I had to do quite a bit of research, and while I was there, I went around all these wildlife sanctuaries and I spent hours and hours and would go back to the same places, and I picked up every leaf there is in the Chesapeake region, I think, and I read them all. But there's a kind of time when you're writing where you just think, probably they don't need to know about the 5 species of duck that Kitty saw out on the marshes that morning. But it's important when you're writing to know that yourself, because it helps to create that feeling that you know that world. And I loved travelling around it so much, and I really saturated myself in it. And I would set out in the end just to get lost in it. Like, I would literally get lost, and then I would think, oh, I suppose I'm going to find my way out of here sometime. And I just did a huge amount of reading. So sometimes I'd think, be specific, what kind of grass is it? So then I'd have to look up the type of grass and the type of grass that grows at a particular depth of water, just so I didn't get that kind of detail wrong. I think it's good to get the names of things right, not only for readers, but for yourself as a writer. I think it's a serious business, writing is. I think you take it seriously. You want people to feel the seriousness of the intent on the page. So those elements of writing are incredibly important to me. So I'm really glad that came through. And I did do all of the explorations through the houses, and I kept on thinking, I probably shouldn't be doing this, and sometimes I'd see a local islander down below and say, look, can you come and check if I'm not out in an hour or so? And they'd say, okay. And then I'd just be, rampaging. These houses are crumbling on the inside. When you hold a stair rail, I just wouldn't kind of hold it. Some of the stairs are just kind of held together by this sodden carpet. It's absolutely fascinating. I don't think I've had as much fun since I was a child. It's wonderful. So I really recommend a Chesapeake holiday and just going out and exploring.
Any more questions?
Thank you, Penny, very much for that holiday destination, Chesapeake Bay, and that sort of messaging. I think we all like to read and learn something from it, and to know the effort that you actually put in to make the authenticity of the book around the setting that you've made. I think that's fantastic. So thank you very much for that, and thank you, John, for your interview. I think it was a terrific conversation, and we really appreciate it. Lucy is going to sign books. We have Torquay Books here. They've got Wolf Island. Have they got the other one? Yes, the other one, Salt Creek's there as well. And John, your book's there too. So, possibility of signing books. We have had a recommendation here that it's a fabulous book. So, I think we're all set for a great read. Thank you very much for coming. I've got a small gift under my chair, and I will get it out and give it to you. Thank you very much, everyone.